Before we get into today's episode, I want to let you know about a source of powerful free resources to help you as a parent or grandparent get equipped to invest in the faith of the next generation. Our Next Gen website has been designed to help empower you to navigate tough issues with the young people in your life. At Next Gen, you'll find articles, entertainment reviews from a Christian perspective, parenting stories, helpful parenting guides, and even answers to the tough questions. All these resources are free as you engage on the front line of raising the next generation for Jesus. So why not register today at premierinsight.org/resources to receive free resources from NextGen. That's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
Hello and welcome. This is Justin Brierley bringing you more conversations that matter here on Unbelievable, broadcasting every Saturday evening on Premier Christian Radio and all over the world via our podcast and indeed over on our YouTube channel. And you can find today's debate on whether the Christmas stories are fact or fairy tale over at the YouTube channel as well. Links to that from our webpage, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. Where you can also get links to the podcast, the social media, the Unbelievable book, and indeed the newsletter as well if you want to follow the show. And don't forget, if you're following us from the US, why not check out our new unbelievable.show website for exclusive updates and resources for listeners in the USA. Something else I want to make you aware of before we jump into today's discussion, trying out a survey mechanic with today's show. There's a link in the description if you're listening via podcast today, and we'd love you to take the survey once you've listened to today's show with just 5 or 6 very simple questions on what you thought of the show, your response to it. We're just trying this out. It's a new bit of kit that we're trying ahead of our big conversation series next year, when we're hoping to be able to do some surveying of the audience and what they think of some of the conversations we have. We thought we'd try it out on today's Christmas show. So do go to that if you can and click on the survey link. We'd be delighted to hear what you made of today's show and your response to it. Later on in the show, we'll hear some of your feedback as well to recent editions of the programme and details of what's coming up over the Christmas and holiday period. For now, let's get into today's festive debate.
You're listening to Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Well, on today's show, we're asking the Christmas story, fact or fairy tale? Now, the Nativity has been described as the greatest story ever told, but is it just a story? Or is there good historical reason to trust in the events recounted in Matthew and Luke around the birth of Jesus? In his book, The Nativity, A Critical Examination, atheist blogger Jonathan Pierce says, we should take the birth narratives of Jesus not as fact, but as theological fiction at best. The story of the virgin birth in Bethlehem, the shepherds and the wise men, etc. No, says my other guest, Christian thinker Lydia McGrew. She's recently published a series of videos arguing for the historical credibility of the birth accounts in Matthew and Luke. So we're asking, is the Christmas story a fact or fairy tale? We're going to decide it right here on Unbelievable tonight. Well, we'll do what we can anyway. Welcome along to the programme, Jonathan and Lydia. Jonathan, we'll start with you. You joined us a few months ago to discuss cancel culture with David French. You're back now really doing something actually that you spent a lot more time researching. What sparked your interest in debunking the Christmas stories specifically?
I think when you look at Jesus and Christianity, you have a benchmark, two bookends to Jesus's life, the Nativity and the Resurrection. And these are the only two areas of Jesus's life that intersect with history, where you can verify some of the claims that are being made. You can either confirm or disconfirm those claims. Now, if they fail, so if when you are able to verify the claims of the Nativity and the Resurrection, they fail, then what on what epistemic basis are you warranted in believing the rest? So the wedding at Cana that has no sort of intersection with history, who was there, what happened, yada, yada, yada. I think it's absolutely vital for approaching the New Testament as a whole, that if you find both the Nativity and the Resurrection problematic, then the whole thing crumbles, falls like a house of cards.
Sure. So you obviously undertook research into this. I mean, is it because you're simply interested in historical details? Is it because you specifically think the Christian story needs to be debunked in some way? What was behind the project itself, as far as you were concerned?
Well, I initially, years, sort of a decade or so ago, I joined a group called The Tippling Philosophers, and we used to meet once a month to discuss all sort of manners of things. And there, at the time, there were some committed Christians, and we used to just fight about these things all the time. And it sort of came out of that, because these... When you only have two gospels and they're so contradictory accounts of the nativity, then I think this is in some respect easy pickings. I mean, I really do think the nativity accounts have some terminal issues, and that sort of got me really interested in researching at greater depth into all of the very many different aspects of the nativity accounts.
Well, thank you very much for coming on the show, coming back on the show to talk about it today. Lydia, welcome back as well. You were with us early in the year, right at the beginning of the year, really, to talk about your own book, The Mirror and the Mask, talking about some of the ways in which you think evangelical historical scholarship has gone in the wrong direction when it comes to assessing the historicity of the Gospels. Obviously, just recently, you've actually turned your attention to these birth narratives themselves. What's made you want to do that, apart from the fact, obviously, that we're running up to Christmas?
Right. Well, I started a YouTube channel this summer, and I decided to do a sort of a meta series on miracle accounts more generally in the Gospels. So I had done a lot of research on, as you know, the reliability of the Gospels. That's my book, Hidden in Plain View, and my book, The Mirror or the Mask, that we discussed in early January. I couldn't remember when we discussed that, so thank you for reminding me when. So I thought, okay, as I'm carrying on this YouTube channel, it would be interesting to talk about how the reliability of the Gospels intersects with specific miracle accounts. And so how does other information that we have lead us to have more respect for specific miracle accounts? And then in certain cases, those miracle accounts might have specific ways in which they're verified and so forth. So I'm going through, I've done the feeding of the 5,000. I've talked about the raising of Jairus's daughter, some of these kinds of things. And so then I thought, well, in the lead up, as you say, here to Christmas, I'll go ahead and do the virgin birth. I don't know exactly which one I'm going to do next. Obviously, the resurrection is a biggie, and I did do one video on that, and my husband Tim and I have done a lot of research on that as well. So that's kind of the overarching theme, is the intersection of gospel reliability and miracle accounts, and I thought it would be good to do a series on the virgin birth, which is something I've never actually discussed before in great detail, so I thought it would be a nice new departure.
Would it be worth, Justin, I wonder, Lydia, if it's impertinent to ask, but are you a biblical inerrantist?
No, I am not.
Right.
As a matter of fact.
Why did you want to clear that one up, if I may ask, Jonathan?
Only because if you're bringing that to the table, then it kind of closes down, I think, an openness to inquiry where you are sort of presupposing this has to be true. I think for a lot of analyses of the nativity, we have something called possibiliter ergo probabiliter, which is if it's possible, therefore it's probable. It's possible, therefore it's probable. So what I mean by that is that if I can think of a conceptual way in which I can harmonize this, some possibility, therefore it's probable, therefore that's what explains it. And I think that particularly happens with inerrantists, but I think will happen no matter what for someone who is wanting to establish the truth.
Be interested in you, just a quick response to that before we move to the subject matter itself, Lydia.
Well, I think you might be surprised. I harmonize Plutarch. So I have an entire section of my book, The Mirror or the Mask, on Plutarch. And Justin knows in more detail the reason for that, but that has to do with some questions about the genre of Plutarch and whether Plutarch's lives involve his deliberately making up certain things and so forth. And what I think when I go to those is that very often the critics who are saying there are these changes that Plutarch's deliberately made are overreading the accounts. I would also suggest harmonizing, for example, different accounts of a car accident or something like that. And that's something that policemen do, judges do. So I actually think that what is sometimes known as harmonization is a legitimate and responsible secular approach to history. It really doesn't have to do so much with being, you know, a Christian or something like that. It's something I think I would do with problem. Secular accounts that appear to differ as well.
Go ahead, Jonathan.
I think this is quite important because when you have two differing accounts and you say, so a policeman takes two statements of what's happened, and I don't think they get harmonized. One is either right and one is right. You know, with the color of a car, you can't harmonize blue and red. Okay, so I think there are some problems with some of these analogies with like newspaper accounts, different newspaper accounts or different witness statements for something that happens. If there are flat out contradictions, I think they should be seen as contradictions.
Let's come to that because, you know, let's talk about some examples. I'm sure, yeah. You know, as we talk about these Christmas stories, we can come to some of these and whether you think the way Lydia approaches them is valid or not in historical terms. Where should we begin? Why not with the sort of the provenance really of the stories? I mean, I've just come from actually, funnily enough, filming a nativity story for our church. And of course, we've been used because we can't gather, you know, all together. We've been sort of separately filming children in scenes to do with shepherds and wise men and all sorts of things. And in our nativity stories, we bung them all into the same story. Of course, in Matthew and Luke's accounts, we have two nativity stories, and the details are frankly quite different between them. I know that for you, Jonathan, this is a major problem, you know, an initial problem which needs to be faced up to. We've got two very different accounts of the birth narratives of Jesus. So what are some of the big issues for you with the actual source material when it comes to Matthew and Luke?
So the big issues are that we in some sense, we don't know who wrote them, when they're written, where they're written exactly. We can have good guesses. They are ex post facto accounts, which is to say that the people who wrote them already believed Jesus was the Messiah and then came to write an account of Jesus' life. That is designed to evangelize, Luke the evangelist, to persuade people. Right, if I was writing an account of David Koresh in 30 years' time and I had no access to telephone, internet, public libraries, public transport, I couldn't verify my claims particularly, and people couldn't verify my claims, and I believed David Koresh was the Messiah. I didn't meet him. I didn't meet any eyewitnesses, contemporaries of his. And I wrote an account of him in 30 years' time to convince people to believe what I believed. So pro Koresh, agenda driven. Then in 2000 years time, if you came to look at my account of David Koresh, there is no way that you could say that that is a reliable source of information with any great, epistemic warrants, I think.
And you obviously think the same sort of thing applies to Matthew and Luke's accounts of the birth narratives. Let's start there then, yes. Lydia. Do you think this is an apt analogy to what's going on in the birth accounts?
Well, I think it's interesting that Jonathan talks about a bias wanting to convince people and so forth. A bias or a personal interest doesn't necessarily render someone who tells about something unreliable per se. For example, Elie Wiesel was no doubt very deeply involved in his own account of the Holocaust, but that doesn't mean he's giving an unreliable account of the Holocaust just because it means a lot to him. A bias in favor of Jesus, in my opinion, is not especially likely to make you invent a virgin birth, to make them invent the slaughter of the innocent, to make the slaughter of the babies in Bethlehem, to make them invent a journey or a census or that kind of thing. There's nothing about their desiring to, have people believe on Jesus, or they're already being Christians, that is actually particularly likely to make them tell about these particular things. In fact, in some ways, some of these things are actually somewhat embarrassing to them. And I can get into that separately. I don't want to go on for too long, but I think the specifics accounts are not predicted by their love of Jesus. Go ahead.
I take it you believe the Quran and the Hadith then? if people can't make things up and aren't willing to mythologize and contextualize theological claims.
Well, no, I mean, you examine the document and decide whether it appears to be accurate or reliable. So when I examine the, in other words, what I'm saying is I don't a priori say because somebody is a follower of this person that makes him reliable or unreliable, because, I mean, you know, what if God really did send a prophet? I'd want to be able to find out. But I don't in fact find the stories of, you know, Muhammad to convince me that he is the prophet of God. Whereas when I look at the birth narratives and other aspects of the Gospels, I try to evaluate them historically, and I think they actually do, in fact, stand up quite well. And I don't think that the specifics that get attacked are the kind of thing that would be produced per se by a desire to attract people to Christianity.
So I was in the garden earlier on wondering what to say tonight. And I mean, so let's rewind a little bit. I mean, when I say I was in the garden, Lydia, I presume you believe me.
You mean you were outside in what we Americans would call it your backyard, right? I don't have any reason.
Yeah, so you, yeah, okay, exactly. So I was in the garden and I was talking to my dragon who normally on a Friday night flies to the moon and back while singing Rule Britannia. And we were discussing what to talk about tonight. And I presume, you know, you would believe that I was talking to my talking dragon, right?
So I'm not suggesting a principle of credulity where anything that anybody says is just automatically something that we accept. I'm not suggesting that. All that I pointed out was that the fact that a person is personally invested in something and that it's important to him does not per se make the person unreliable. And so that's my point. I'm not saying that I just believe everything
but
that someone tells me.
Extraordinary...
Justin wants to.
I want to first of all just answer one of the first things you questioned there and see what you have to make of it, Jonathan, which was we don't know who wrote this. We don't know where they wrote it. What's your view on that, Lydia? Do you think you have a reasonable idea of who wrote these accounts in Matthew and Luke and how long after the fact they were set down and that kind of thing? Just be interested in your perspective.
Yes, I absolutely do. I think that we have excellent evidence based on the patristic sources concerning the authorship of Matthew, which would have placed him in a position such that he could have spoken to Jesus' brothers. Joseph was probably dead by the time of Jesus' ministry, so Matthew probably didn't know Joseph personally. Luke, as far as whether his name was Luke or not, I think probably it was. But aside from that, I think we have excellent evidence based on especially the book of Acts that he was a companion of the Apostle Paul. That would have put him in an excellent position. And I also think we have a lot of evidence for their scrupulousness historically. It's astounding. I have a lecture out there that I did recently called Acts Gets Hard Things Right. And that's just the tip of the iceberg of some of the verifications we have of the book of Acts. So it's actually very strong. And I would say that just to begin with, one category of evidence for the accuracy of the birth narratives, and at least they're coming from reliable sources or people sources that the author thought were reliable, lies in our other knowledge of that author of Luke and Acts.
Okay, so let's start maybe with Luke, who, you know, Lydia obviously believes is also the author of Acts. And indeed, you know, when I look at the account that Luke sets down right there in chapter one, it explicitly says, since many have undertaken to set down an orderly account of the events that have been fulfilled among us and so on. This is Luke saying, here I am to reliably record the events, and obviously begins with the story, firstly, of Elizabeth and Zechariah and then Mary and the Annunciation. Now, Lydia goes so far as to say it could even be quite plausible in her view that Luke was able to interview Mary and to get these, you know, this account firsthand, writing, you know, in the 50s, perhaps Mary quite an, you know, in those days, elderly woman by then, but still able to recall what happened. So why for you is this all just too far-fetched historically as far as you're concerned, Jonathan?
Well, what I was trying to set out earlier was extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence. And this is absolutely true. Like, you would happily believe I was in my garden, but you won't believe that I've got a talking dragon. So we need, when we are making extraordinary claims, we are required, what is required of us is to provide extraordinary evidence. And these are extraordinary claims. Matthew and Luke make extraordinary claims and they contradict. You have to have extraordinarily good evidence in order to support those claims and for the thesis that they are true to be the most probable thesis. And I don't think in any stretch of the imagination these are extraordinary evidences. I mean, Luke and Matthew, neither of them use any historiographical techniques that were used at the time, but even by fairly poor historians like Suetonius and Plutarch and Xenophon, and then you've got Arrian, Polybius and Thucydides. So these guys discussed their sources and they said, right, that was anonymous, so count that for a little bit worse, oral tradition, blah, blah, blah. And these, Matthew and Luke, do nothing of the sort. So these are not extraordinarily good evidence to support the extraordinary claims. It's that simple.
Lydia.
So, yeah, actually, it's interesting. We don't find it to be a common thing in ancient historians for them to, like, literally go, you know, scene by scene, passage by passage. I got this one from this guy and this guy. I'm not saying that Thucydides never names a source, but the more common thing, I mean, I have a quotation here. I won't take the time to read from Thucydides' introduction to his Peloponnesian War, 121 to 22. And it's kind of extraordinary, if I can use this word, how much it sounds like Luke's introduction to Luke. He mentions eyewitnesses, but he doesn't name them. And in the same way, when Luke, in that section that Justin began to read, specifically says, as these were passed, handed down to us by those who from the beginning were eyewitnesses and servants of the word. As Richard Baucom has pointed out, what Luke is doing there is he's placing himself in the very next sort of line, next in line to what are called the autoptais, the eyewitnesses. So that's actually quite a lot, like what we find in Thucydides, also Dionysius of Halicarnassus, saying, I interviewed people and that kind of thing, but not necessarily saying, you know, and one of them was Joe or whatever. So I think that's certainly true. As far as extraordinary claims requiring extraordinary evidence, of course, we're going to take all our evidence together. And it's certainly true that there's indirect influence. If you think that there's good reason to believe Jesus was God, and that's like a separate question, then that's going to feed through. And I've done work on epistemic routing in my professional work in philosophy. That's going to feed through to, support these accounts as well. But I also make arguments from their apparent earliness, their other connections to the Jewish milieu, and that kind of thing, that they really don't look like late historical inventions. And so that is reason to think. And in fact, the virgin birth could have offended a Jewish audience.
Obviously,
so that's reason to think. Have some truth.
There's a key difference, though, between you both here. When it comes to this idea of extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence, I can understand why you would say that, Jonathan. You're an atheist. And so it would have to be extremely good evidence to make you think that a virgin conceived and that a divine star guided wise men to, you know, the place of the birth and all of that sort of thing. I guess for Lydia, who believes there is a God and miracles are therefore possible, she doesn't need quite as high a bar of evidence to be surpassed in order to believe that. So is your kind of
really
atheism kind of from the outset going to mean that almost any degree of evidence wouldn't actually convince you because you'd have to go with a naturalistic explanation for any of this?
Well, so some of the claims aren't particularly supernatural, actually, within. I mean, it's the census that you would ask for a census that requires going to your ancestral home from 41 generations past. Right. No census in the history of humanity has ever asked for this. This was a census that took place under Quirinius in 6 CE that was for Judea. They lived in Galilee. There's a different tax place. The census go to towns. They don't have people come move away. If you're doing a tax census, Herod Archelaus ruled for 10 years in Judea. He was rubbish, so they deposed him, and the Romans took over the rule, which is why they had a census for tax purposes. You don't get every single person to look back. I mean, why 41? Why not 30? Why not 20? Why not 100? And go back to their ancestral homes, get up and go. I mean, there would be economic suicide. It's just insane. So that's not a supernatural claim. And we can talk about circularity of supernatural, like I believe supernatural is more probable, so therefore I believe these, and that makes me believe in Jesus. And then believing Jesus makes me believe that supernatural is more probable. And I do think there's a circularity there. But some of these claims are not supernatural. They are just bonkers. And in
okay,
order to believe
well,
that,
just tease that one out just so that Lydia can respond to it properly. You've got a problem with the census. Is that because, and do you think the reason this census is there in Luke's gospel is because he needs some way to get them to Bethlehem to fulfill some prophecies? Is that what you think is going on?
You have this massive problem is that Jesus as an adult is known as Jesus of Nazareth because he supposedly lives there, although that's to fulfill a prophecy that he's a Nazarene, which is an incorrect interpretation, misinterpretation of a prophecy. Anyway, you've got the adult Jesus living in Nazareth and needs to be born in Bethlehem because of another prophecy, which is again a misinterpretation of a prophecy saying he has to be born in Bethlehem because it's the city of David. So how they get Jesus from Bethlehem to Nazareth, or Nazareth, Bethlehem and Nazareth, they do in two completely different ways. Matthew uses Herod, who died in 4 or 5 CE, so this would have happened in 6 or 7 CE, and Luke uses the Quirinius census of 6 CE, so there's a 10 to 12 year gap here. That is impossible. These two events could not have happened at the same time. And we know that for a whole bunch of historical reasons that we can cross-reference with coinage, Cassius Dio, Josephus, Tacitus, blah, 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 blah. But these two things didn't happen at the same time. Fact.
Okay.
So
Lydia, I'm going to let you come back on this, but we're going to go to a break first. We'll leave our audience hanging by their fingernails, wondering if Lydia can answer this particular conundrum around the census. It's one I've heard before, and I've heard some interesting responses to it as well. We'll be back in just a moment's time. Lydia McGrew and Jonathan Pierce are my guests today as we ask, is the Christmas story fact or fiction?
Listening to Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Well, I've got my Bible out for today's edition of the show because I'm trying to look up some of these references in Luke and Matthew. We're talking about the Christmas story here on Unbelievable. Is it fact or fiction? My guests are Lydia McGrew and Jonathan Pierce. Jonathan Pierce's book, The Nativity, A Critical Examination, essentially says that it's theological fiction. None of this stuff really happened. We really can't know historically that any of this stuff happened. It was all embellishment after the fact. Not so, says Christian thinker Lydia McGrew, who's recently published some videos on the historical credibility of the birth accounts in Matthew and Luke. And just in that last section, we'd moved on to the issue of the census, which is a thorny issue. How do you reconcile the fact that other records appear to show, Lydia, that this census took place later than Luke has it happening, given that it's supposed to happen within the reign of Herod? As far as Jonathan sees it, this is an irreconcilable problem. Someone's got it wrong, and it sort of calls into the question the whole thing. What's your view on that?
Well, I found it kind of interesting that Jonathan cast this as a contradiction between Luke and Matthew. And I thought that was interesting because actually Luke is very explicit that this happened during the reign of Herod the Great. In Luke 1, he actually locates the conception of John the Baptist, which was just 6 months before he locates the conception of Jesus in the reign of Herod. So there's no contradiction as far as that's concerned. The other thing is that, it's very common to use the term the census and then to imply that Luke is aiming for a pretty well-known census in 6 AD under Quirinius, who came in to kind of clean up the mess, as Jonathan pointed out, after Archelaus had been a tetrarch there. And actually, I don't think we should assume that Luke is aiming to portray it as occurring as being that census. In fact, if anything, Luke makes some kind of, his phrase is a little hard to translate, that this was the first census when Quirinius was governor, or this census was first completed when Quirinius was governor, this census was before Quirinius was governor. He's got this phrase in there and he's trying to get something across. But the other thing is Luke actually knows about the 6th AD census, and he knows that it was later, I think, because he talks about it, well, indirectly, Gamaliel talks about it in Acts. There's a speech that Luke records where he talks about a rebellion that occurred because people were upset about Quirinius' census in 6 AD. So right away, Luke doesn't seem to be necessarily aiming for that census. Now, we know there was a lustrum, what was called a lustrum registration census under Caesar Augustus in 8 BC. That's recorded in the Acts of Caesar later on. So it seems to me entirely plausible that this was the Syrian portion. Those things didn't, you know, it's not like they all happened in one year, that this was the Syrian portion of that lustrum census. Whether Quirinius was directly involved in it, Luke uses the term hegemon, he was hegemon. I might opt for the translation, which is preferred by N.T. Wright. This census was before the one when Quirinius was governor of Syria. Alternatively, if he's saying this was the first of two that were made when Quirinius was hegemon, then it could be that because of the incompetence of some other governors of that time, like Varus, who was notoriously incompetent, that and because of a falling out that was happening also around that time between Herod the Great and Caesar Augustus, that possibly Quirinius, who was alive at that time and was a military commander, might have had some involvement in organizing this.
Is the reason why you're willing to give Luke the benefit of the doubt in this case because you think he's generally a fairly reliable historian elsewhere, and you don't see why he would make this particular mistake in this part of the gospel?
That's part of it. Definitely that's part of it. But also I would say that there's no reason for him to invent a census. It's very common for people to say what, skeptics to say what Jonathan said, that he's got to sort of get them to Bethlehem. That is breaking a nut with a jackhammer. It would be much easier if all he wants to do is have him born in Bethlehem to just, he's already said it's, during the days of Herod. So there's no contradiction with Matthew, to just sort of start them out in Bethlehem and then have Joseph later decide to go carry on his carpentry business up in Nazareth and move them up there. He doesn't need to invent an entire census.
It's a very complex thing to kind of use as a deus ex machina to kind of make things pull together.
Right, to move them around.
I want Jonathan to respond here, though. So sure.
Yeah,
let's hear from Jonathan a bit.
Well, actually, all of the points that you made earlier, with all due respect, have been thoroughly debunked. The big problem is that before Quirinius, it was a client kingdom, and client kingdoms did not have censuses. And the oath-bearing census, I think you were referring to, it's not really a census, the oath-bearing ceremony was only for Roman citizens, wouldn't have happened in Judea or Galilee. Absolutely, they just don't stand up to any kind of scrutiny. And I think the reason why the census was used was Psalm 87:6, in the census of the people, the one will be born there. So I think there's foreshadowing that's going on from Psalm 87 here. And I think this is just a really common technique where we have, so-called prophecy after prophecy, which are basically just verses taken out of the Old Testament and then superimposed into the Jesus story to give it, to give it theological gravitas. But I think when you talk about Luke earlier being particularly accurate, do you know what? Arthur Conan Doyle was accurate about Sherlock Holmes's context of London and the places and the people and the things that happen, but it doesn't make Sherlock Holmes true. So I think Luke can be accurate with the context, but it has absolutely no bearing on the truth claims of the Jesus events.
Well, it's kind of interesting that you say it has absolutely no bearing, and yet you think that the supposed inaccuracy of the census does have a bearing. You can't have it both ways. You can't at the same time say, well, when he gets a whole bunch of things right, and believe me, a lot of these are way more subtle than anything Arthur Conan Doyle was getting right, that has absolutely no bearing. But when I think he's getting it wrong, then that should just make us distrust him. That's actually a double standard. I wanted to address something that Jonathan said earlier about
quite.
Everybody going back for 41
I'll let you come back
generations.
On that,
so, but we can, 41 generations, you know, whoever going back, whoever was your ancestor from 41 generations ago. I think you could decide to read Luke that way, but I actually think that's an overly rigid reading because for one thing, obviously, how do you choose which of your ancestors from 1,000 years ago to go back to? I tend to think that Joseph's family probably had some other connection there with the town of Bethlehem, which may have been partly because they were descended from David. They would be proud of that. But I don't think we should press overly hard on, you know, he went back, everyone to his own city, says Luke. And we actually have a precedent for this in about 100 AD to go back to your own home. I tend to think that it's likely Joseph had a connection to Bethlehem, a familial connection, and that Luke is not saying, you know, everybody in the entire Roman Empire had to go back to a place where their ancestors lived 1,000 years ago. Yes, he was of the house and lineage of David. Yes, that was connected to the fact that his family was in Bethlehem, but I don't think that we need to interpret this as broadly as Jonathan interprets it.
Jonathan.
I have a real problem with the, I mean, this is a really common apologist defense of part of the census thing. And they talk about a census in about 100, which is an Egyptian census, which required itinerant workers to return to their home. It's not about ancestral homes. It's a complete false analogy, right? Or a false precedence. The only time that we found a census which requires people to go to somewhere else for the census is for itinerant workers who are working on some building or something over there, and they have to come home to where they live normally. They're just away working. They come home, they have the census, and they go back working. That is not picking an arbitrary ancestor going back to the city that they were from. I mean, half the people would be going abroad. You know, it's just. And the other thing is, why would you have a census? Why would you have a census? No one has ever answered this. That decrees that you go back to an ancestor. What's the practical use? Think about what a census does.
That was just what I was just questioning. That was the point I was just making. Actually, the inscription in the Egyptian case doesn't say itinerant workers, but it says anyone who, for any reason, is away, you know, away from their home. We have analogies in our own time that you have, college kids. I mean, this is a modern analogy, but young people who are working, or people who still have a different address on their driver's license, and they're living part of the time in another state, and they're in a sense away from home. Joseph was a builder. He was a carpenter. He could carry his tools, you know, in a bag over his shoulder. He's courting, marrying a girl in Nazareth, who, by the way, according to Luke, has family in the Judean hill country anyway, which could be how the families get to know one another. So he's living in Nazareth, but he considers his home to be in Bethlehem. I don't really see a problem there, and I'm actually questioning idea that it was had to be an ancestral home from 1,000 years ago. That's kind of my point, that I don't think we should overpress that idea.
What one response, Jonathan, and then I do want to move towards the virgin birth issue as well.
Okay, well, I think you're just inventing coulds. You're going to this possibility, ergo probability, and I think using false analogies and saying, well, and this is not evidence at all. It's not what Luke says. And in fact, I would defer to Raymond Brown, who's the greatest, you know, biblical exegete I think that's ever lived. And he even says, indeed, as regards the non-biblical evidence, it is doubtful that anyone would even thought about an earlier census if he were not trying to defend Luke in accuracy.
Oh, but there is an earlier census.
Fact,
I mean, there's an actual lustrum census in ABC. But anyway, I think Justin wants to move on.
We should move on. I accept that you guys obviously disagree, and that's fine. And people can go and read further on the arguments for and against the accuracy of the census. Okay, but obviously at the centre of this story is a woman who claims to have been conceived by the Holy Spirit the savior of the world. It is a pretty extraordinary claim, isn't it, Lydia? Okay, so Jonathan, I suppose the first thing I want to establish, Jonathan, is what do you take as possible in the story? I mean, do you believe there was a Mary? Do you believe she gave birth to someone called Jesus? I mean, is there anything within the story that you can say yes to, even if you're obviously going to dismiss?
You know what? That's a good question. I'm not a Jesus mythicist. So I believe an itinerant preacher, Jesus, lived and was crucified and we had cognitive dissonance and blah, blah, blah. And you get mythologized, embellished accounts of his life. What I think the Gospels tell us is so far removed from the original nugget of truth that it might as well be myth. So I'm almost synonymous with being a Jesus mythicist because I don't think the Gospels tell us anything that is particularly factual. Maybe Jesus was born in Nazareth or Bethlehem, or Mark has him living in Capernaum. So, you know, there's just sort of disagreements all over the shop. I think what's interesting to wonder is why, when Matthew and Luke are so similar, because they rely on the same sources of Mark and possibly Q, depending on what your theories are, and each other, arguably, depending on what your theories are, why do they differ? And actually, the skeptic needs to answer this as much as the theist. Why do they differ in their nativity accounts? And I think the best theory is that Luke 1 and 2 are later interpolations. Again, Raymond Brown believes this, because the Greek is different in 1 and 2. It's very Semitic, literary, fine Greek. And then chapter 3 becomes Koine Greek, common Koine Greek, and different theologies. So I think 1 and 2 is an interpolation because you never hear about the virgin birth ever again after that. I think, you know, those to me is what explains the differences. Okay. That would explain it. The earliest loops don't have 1 and 2 in. They start at 3.
Okay. And presumably the reason it's there as an interpolation is because later on you believe someone wanted to kind of beef up the kind of divine credentials of Jesus, give him a great backstory and that kind of thing. Is that the idea?
Well, yeah, that's where it gets interesting, is why they might interpolate. I think possibly there are theories that there are arguments against the Marcionites. So the Marcionites early, who were kind of a heretical sect, as they were seen, they had an early Evangelion version of Luke that didn't have 1 and 2. And then there might have been some argument and then they came back and later interpolated either Luke did himself or someone else. But I think that explains why they differ only there, particularly. And I think, you know, when you start talking about the virgin birth, you are having Jesus competing with Caesar Augustus, who was Divi Filius, the son of God. He was the savior of the world. He had a miraculous birth. Jesus has to be better than that. And he has to also be better than John the Baptist, who Luke gave a miraculous birth to. So Jesus has to have a miraculous birth.
Okay. All right. So there's plenty to respond to there, Lydia. Obviously, we don't have time to respond to the general issue of the historicity of the Gospels that obviously Jonathan has an issue with. But let's talk specifically about Luke. Interpolation, Luke 1 and 2, says Jonathan, that's the best explanation for him of the differences in the grammar and so on in the Greek, and put there because there needed to be a divine kind of start to the story that obviously someone felt was needed adding. So yeah, comments on that.
Well, a couple things I want to comment on. First of all, Luke's Greek continues to be excellent all the way through. The idea that Luke's Greek becomes, you know, like lower after you get to chapter 3 is just completely wrong. And I kind of doubt Raymond Brown says that. There are some Semitisms for sure in Luke 1 and 2. But there's also this interesting, what I would call Lucan interest in Roman history. In fact, the very issue of the census that we were just discussing, which I'm not trying to bring back up qua issue, but I'm just pointing out how Lucan that is and how characteristic that is, so that then you get to 3:1 and he suddenly, it's like, you know, in the reign of, and he lists all these different, by the way, those are all accurate, which is excellent, but all these different tetrarchs and so forth, that actually fits really well with those introductory four verses, the reference with its odd phrase about Quirinius in Luke 2 and so forth. I do not think that it's an interpolation, but I do think that Luke is working with some extremely early sources. And I think that's interesting. And I think the Jewish character, which Jonathan himself noted, is part of the reason why this theory about competing with Caesar Augustus is just completely wrong and incredible indeed. There is not the slightest appearance of an attempt to compete with Caesar Augustus or an attempt to appeal to a Gentile audience by making Jesus out to be greater than Caesar Augustus or in competition with him. I don't find that in the apostles. I don't find that in the epistles. I don't find that in the gospels or anything of the kind. They have indeed a kind of aggressively Jewish character to them that I think if you were a highly learned Gentile who knew, like, you know, pagan mythology, would almost put you off, because it's like, what's all this stuff about the purification and the course of Abijah, and it's almost prudish in the absence of anything sexual in it. So I do think we find that they're very early. So what I think about that difference in the sort of flavor of those first couple of chapters is that Luke, that's evidence actually that Luke is getting this from Mary or from Mary's family, with just that it breathes the very air of pre-70 AD Judaism, to the point that you get what I consider to be the strongest evidence perhaps within the accounts themselves, which is all this stuff about Jesus, you know, making his people safe from their enemies. That comes up in the Song of Zechariah. We should be safe from our enemies, or his reigning on the throne of his father David, which in an earthly sense Jesus didn't fulfill. So it's almost embarrassingly messianic and early and Jewish. And I think that shows the sincerity of the author in just recording it, even though he knows that Jesus died and went away. And
the reason you're referencing this sounding pre-AD 70 is, of course, because AD 70 was when the destruction of Jerusalem happened, the temple, and a massive change in the way Jewish people started to relate to themselves and their story in that sense. And for you, it doesn't feel like this could have been written after that time. It feels like someone was setting down these accounts and saying these things in a pre-AD 70 kind of world. So for you, that's some kind of evidence of its earlier provenance and it sitting within the kind of the followers of Jesus tradition in the first generation or two. Well, let's come back to you, Jonathan. There's again, plenty to respond to there. I mean, the one thing I wanted to put in here as well is just a bit of a simpler point, really, but it's often one of the points that preachers often make in their Christmas sermons, is that in a way it was very humble. It's in a stable, it's Jesus laid in a manger in Luke because there's no room for them at the inn. It doesn't sound like it's trying to compete with Augustus in terms of, you know, the grandeur. What do you think? What is it trying to do something else in the story? What do you think?
So I was reading something today, actually, that suggested that the miraculous birth and the Son of God and the same kind of language is competing with Caesar Augustus, but then it subverts everything. So everything's almost the opposite of this militaristic leader. And I think it almost necessarily has to be because of the nature of who Jesus became. And this is part of the problem with the messianic nature of Jesus being a bit of a letdown for some of those Jews who might have been expecting some kind of warrior king, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, it's not very clear necessarily what kind of Messiah the Messiah was going to be, and so you get, you know, these competing kind of ideas. But I think, you know, there are disagreements even within Luke and Matthew about where Jesus was born. And then when you look at the non-canonical gospels and you start getting caves and so on and so forth, in fact some of the early church fathers prefer the cave for the birth. It just seems to be a big hot mess of different sort of contradictions and ideas. And then when you start bringing Herod in, I mean, you've got to remember that for Matthew, Jesus is the new Moses and Herod is the Pharaoh. So the only reason the Magi come along is to get Herod involved. So they're following a star. The star gets lost. The star gets lost so they can walk around Jerusalem and get Herod involved, who finds out about a prophecy that he'd never heard about before. Then instead of following the star himself or sending an armed guard with the Magi, he trusts them, which is very unlike him. They go away. They come back a different way after getting a dream sequence. why didn't God give the Magi dream sequence before Jerusalem so they didn't get Herod involved? So Herod then goes and kills innocent children because Jesus was born. So Jesus is almost causally responsible for the death of those children when God could have given the Magi dream sequence before Jerusalem, not afterwards. And then Jesus then goes to Egypt for a couple of years, and Luke has none of this, and then comes out of Egypt to fulfill the prophecy, out of Egypt, my son is caught, which is very important for Matthew because Jesus is the new Moses and Herod is the Pharaoh, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, you turn over one stone and it leads you to down this path, and it's all so interconnected and thoroughly dubious.
Well, this opens up another big area, and let's try and do it justice in the 5 or so minutes we've got in before we go to our next break. But yes, I mean, okay, a lot of people have said this before, Lydia. You've got the wise men story, the Herod story, and all of that going on in Matthew. Not a peep about it in Luke, not a peep about the flight to Egypt and so on. And I think a lot of people do see Jonathan's point here. It looks like Matthew's creating events in order to fulfill certain prophecies, make things happen. And wouldn't you expect to hear something about it in Luke? You know, this is fairly major sort of events that seem to be silent on in Luke's account. So how do you respond to that?
Well, the argument from silence is absolutely terrible in history. My husband, Tim, has an article on that, a professional article about a Bayesian analysis of the argument from silence. You'd be astonished the things that people don't tell, don't mention. And I could give examples of those, but I'm trying to save time here. Things that you would say, oh, I would think they would mention, and they don't. I think it's entirely possible nobody told Luke. I don't think he had Matthew, by the way. I think it's entirely possible that they didn't tell him about the flight to Egypt for possibly their own reasons, not wanting to tick off the Herods if he published it or something of that kind. I'm not saying that Luke knew about it and suppressed it, but the argument from silence is a poor one. And a mere absence is not a contradiction. And I want to emphasize this. And there is, in fact, no contradiction between Matthew and Luke about where Jesus was born. And there's absolutely no reason to bring in the non-canonical gospels here, because I'm not here to defend them. But as far as where he was born, there's no contradiction between them there. They both agree that he was born in Bethlehem. As far as Matthew making it up to fulfill prophecy, once again, that's extremely awkward. The out of Egypt, have I called my sons, as people have often mentioned, is talking about Israel itself. And so it's awkward for Matthew to have to do that. I think the very awkwardness of the prophecies that Matthew brings up in their application to the events shows that he sincerely believed that these events had happened. And it's because he believes that these events have happened, and because he's a Jew and he has a rabbinic mind, that he goes back and tries to find, sometimes apparently rather awkwardly, what look like prophecies to him or things that could apply or foretell this. If he wanted to make Jesus the so-called new Moses, there are other things he could have done a lot more easily, because it's allegedly not constrained by fact. He could have had Jesus, you know, parting a body of water as a child or something, instead of inventing a flight to Egypt and then trying to invent a meaning for a verse that appears to have a different meaning. So I would actually flip that completely on its head. I don't think this has any appearance of Matthew making up these events to try to make Jesus fulfill prophecy, but rather of Matthew trying to find prophecy to fit events that he independently, sincerely believed he had good reason to think happened.
I will let you respond in a moment, Jonathan. Just before we go to the break, though, one thing else that occurs to me is obviously Luke's perspective seems to be on Mary. Matthew seems to say a lot more about Joseph. Do you have a theory for that, Lydia? Why Matthew focuses on the particular, you know, circumstances of Joseph, and, you know, should he marry her, and the dream, and all of that kind of thing?
Yeah, I think that's one of the most striking things about them. It shows their independence, and yet it shows their independence in this really interesting way. I've already said, and you've mentioned, about the idea that Luke may have interviewed Mary or had information that came from her side of the family. It seems to me at least plausible from that Josephine perspective that Matthew may have had stories that were told by Joseph, possibly to, you know, other people, Jesus, other brothers, maybe even Jesus himself. And once again, this is something historians do. This is not something I'm doing as a Christian. Historians will do that. They'll say, well, you know, how could this person have known about this, or how can we make sense of this? And as you say, the datum in this case is that strong focus on what Joseph knew and what was especially of interest to him.
Well, I will come back to you, Jonathan, to comment on this fact that obviously Lydia believes an argument from silence isn't necessarily a contradiction. And also, you know, this fact that she does think there's a plausible historical reason why Matthew focuses on the Joseph side of the account. We'll come back in just a short moment's time. You're listening to a great debate here on Unbelievable on whether the Christmas story is fact or fairy tale. Arguing for fairy tale, or at least theological fiction, is one guest, Jonathan Pierce. Lydia McGrew is arguing for the historicity of these stories, and we'll be back very shortly. Hello, welcome back to the third and final part of this week's edition of Unbelievable with me, Justin Brierley, returning to the debate on the Christmas stories in the Bible very shortly. But shout out first to Kenneth on Instagram, who gets in touch this last week to say, "Hi, Justin, just want to say how Unbelievable is the best place for apologetics, a neutral zone away from party lines, that melting pot of great content where a seeker can come knowing full well they'll be getting a balanced diet. Keep it up, sir." Thank you, Kenneth. And Kenneth actually is someone who I used to work with here at Premier. So good to hear from you, Kenneth. If you want to get in touch with the show, at UnbelievableJB for Twitter, facebook.com/UnbelievableJB for the Facebook page, Justin.Brierley for our Instagram. That's where I do most of my talking about the show on Instagram. There are other ways as well to get in touch. You can do it in email, unbelievable@premier.org.uk. Feel free to leave comments, of course, underneath today's show at the website, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable, or indeed the YouTube channel. And thanks to those who've been getting in touch as well about some of our classic replay editions of the show. The most recent to go out, and these tend to go out on a Tuesday, sort of midweek, so that you get a classic taste of Unbelievable from yesteryear. A brilliant discussion that we're going to be putting out this week and next on How Did Christianity Begin, between James Crossley and Michael Bird. Look out for that if you're listening via podcast. It's well worth checking out those special classic replay midweek shows as well. We've had some good blogs as well up on our Pathos website in the last week or so. N.T. Wright on why we can trust the Christmas narrative, so obviously related to some of what's been said on today's show. And John Lennox also blogging on the case for Christmas. So look out for that over at pathos.com/blogs/unbelievable, or just go to the webpage to find out more. If you're coming back next week for Unbelievable, then a Christmas special co-hosted with Ruth Jackson is what you're going to be getting over Christmas weekend. Highlights from the past year, plus Nick Page on putting to bed modern myths about our pagan Christmas celebrations, and some amazing stories of people finding faith in this last year, both through Unbelievable and through other apologetics. So look out for that on your podcast or on your radio set same time next week. If you're listening later on tonight here on Premier Christian Radio, Joshua Luke Smith is sitting down to talk with Sam Hales on The Profile. He's a Christian rapper. I absolutely love his stuff. He's got a brilliant way with words, has Joshua. So check that out on The Profile tonight at 8 p.m. or indeed over on its own Profile podcast. Let's get back into today's discussion.
You're listening to Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Well, time to conclude this debate today on the Christmas story between my guests Jonathan Pierce and Lydia McGrew. If you want more from them, Jonathan blogs at A Tippling Philosopher over at pathos.com. More about Lydia at her website, lydiamcgrew.com. She's recently started a YouTube channel as well, where you can find some of her videos on the Christmas narratives. I'll make sure there are links to both of you from today's show, folks. Just in that last section, Jonathan, Lydia was making the point that, well, an argument from silence doesn't entail a contradiction. There are lots of times that people remain silent for various reasons. And she also believes, actually, there's a sort of an independence between the accounts that is applicable if they're simply working essentially from different sources. But at the core of it, you've got Jesus born in Bethlehem and an account of a virgin birth and, you know, and all the rest of it. So there's enough there that binds them together to not see this as being any irreconcilable differences. Responses, and we'll go for a little bit on this one.
I'll take your second, Lydia's second point first, or your second point first, and just very quick, because we're going to be short for time, very quickly refer to Raymond Brown, who, as I said, I think is a is The Birth of the Messiah is a magisterial volume. On page 35, he says, but if originally there was one narrative, how did it ever become fragmented into the two different accounts we have now? As I hinted above, the suggestion that Matthew is giving Joseph's remembrance of events while Luke is giving Mary's is just a pious deduction from the fact that Joseph dominates Matthew's account and Mary dominates Luke's. In point of fact, how could Joseph ever have told the story in Matthew and not have reported the Annunciation of Mary? And how could Mary have been responsible for the story in Luke and never have mentioned the coming of the Magi and the flight to Egypt? So to go on to the argument for silence, this is an oft-held position by theists. I've written a chapter on this in my upcoming book on the resurrection, because when you expect to hear something, an argument from silence is actually an absence of evidence is evidence of absence when you fully expect it. Okay, just in general, you can say, yeah, well, because we hadn't heard about it, doesn't mean it didn't happen. But if you absolutely expect there to be evidence for it and don't find that evidence, that is disconfirmation. And I think that certainly applies. You can apply that to Paul's silence here. Paul says nothing. Mark says nothing about the nativity accounts whatsoever. And in fact, they're not mentioned in the Gospels after the nativity accounts. The virgin birth is never mentioned again. Bethlehem's never mentioned again. And I think when Lydia said Matthew going to Egypt for 2 years is not a contradiction, it is. And here is why it's a contradiction. Luke has Mary and Joseph purifying for 32 days and then taking Jesus to the temple in Jerusalem and then going straight to Nazareth. It is when they finished purifying, they went to the temple, then went home. There is no 2 years in Egypt. I can't say when I went to the shops or when I finished cooking, I went to the shops. Doesn't mean when I finished cooking, I went to Egypt for 2 years and then went to the shops. Whereas Matthew has them going to Egypt for 2 years after the birth and then not going back to Bethlehem, which they wanted to do, it seems, because it was too dangerous, going to Nazareth for the first time. That is a contradiction.
So, a lot there to respond to. First of all, as far as the general notion about the argument from silence and this statement about, quote, absolutely expecting something, this is not a pious matter or a Christian matter. The article I just mentioned earlier about the argument from silence was a secular article, and you would be surprised at the things that we, quote, absolutely expect. Ulysses S. Grant in his memoir never mentions the Emancipation Proclamation. Grafton's English Chronicles has a section on the reign of King John, but never mentions Magna Carta. So we need to calibrate in history. Again and again, we find things where we would, quote unquote, absolutely expect somebody to mention something and he doesn't. So we're really bad. We human beings are apparently really bad at judging what somebody would mention. Now, you do bring up what I would call literally the one and only even apparent discrepancy between the accounts. I mean, it's really interesting to see how people will refer to, oh, there's all these discrepancies between Matthew and Luke. Literally that one about the return after the purification is the only one that I would even acknowledge to be an apparent discrepancy. And I do acknowledge it to be an apparent discrepancy because I would say it looks to me like Luke is describing an immediate return. This is where the fact that I'm not an inerrantist is valuable, I think. I think that Luke did not hear about the flight to Egypt. I think he didn't know about it. And like with anything else, you obviously don't think somebody took a 2-year trip to Egypt if nobody mentioned a 2-year trip to Egypt to you. You're not going to just invent that out of nowhere. He doesn't have access to Matthew, I believe. So my guess is that the person he was talking to, or possibly even a written source he may have had, had the story of the birth and the purification, and then just next had the story of Jesus in the temple at age 12, which comes next. And it's interesting to see how those two verses in Matthew, those transitional verses, where he says, when they had accomplished all the things in the law, they returned to Nazareth, which he knew was true, that they did return to Nazareth. And then the other one, Jesus increased in wisdom and strength, how generic they sort of are. And it looks to me like Luke, as a good author, is making a transition based upon what he sincerely believes to be true in his source. It's like, well, I know they went back to Nazareth and Jesus grew up in Nazareth. And, you know, what was Jesus' childhood like? He grew, you know, and then he's going to start with the next story he has, which is Jesus at age 12 in the temple. So whether that would be considered compatible with inerrancy or not, I suppose probably it wouldn't be considered compatible with inerrancy. But Luke is still just incredibly reliable. And in this case too, I think he's completely sincere here, and he's putting together the stories that he has in a way that makes sense to him and flows gracefully.
And so what I'm hearing from you here, Lydia, is that you're not committed to the idea that Luke had to know about this and just didn't bother putting it in. It's that you just feel that it's certainly possible that the flight to Egypt happened, but Luke didn't have that information and simply kind of assumed that there was a continuous series of events going back, you know, when they went back to Nazareth, and may simply have been genuinely mistaken. And had he known, might have put that in his document, but it doesn't present, as far as you're concerned, any problem with the events actually did take place as described in Matthew in that
sense. Correct.
Yep. Right. Jonathan. Yeah. I'm imagining you're more used to hearing Christians kind of coming back with some kind of complex harmonization here, saying, you know, well, if you do this and this and put them together or whatever.
And that's an interesting position. But I find it quite incredible that when Joseph and Mary are the original sources, I mean, they have to be. They're the only other people other than Jesus who are, you know, they're two original sources, have to be. How you can have the king of the country come along and chase the family out of the country for 2 years and kill children, and also act completely bizarrely in doing so, and not have that in one. It beggars belief. I mean, it also reminds me that Herod was a vicious guy, but he was only interested in the here and now. And this is a prophecy that was going to come to fruition in 20 years' time when Jesus was an adult, right? So he was ill. We know that at this time he was ill, over 70, very ill, tried to commit suicide. Why he would be worried about a prophecy that would come to fruition in 20 years and then do these bizarre things that are not attested to anywhere outside of Matthew in the world. It's bizarre.
So I'd like to maybe respond to that briefly. Once again, so this is bringing up to my mind, even worse argument from Silence concerning the slaughter of the innocent. I mean, if the one about the flight to Egypt was shaky, the one about the slaughter of the innocent is an absolutely terrible argument from Silence. Bethlehem was a small town. It was, you know, we're talking maybe a couple dozen babies, and it was a brutal age. When Josephus records Herod's misdeeds, he most often records the ones that are of political relevance and might not even have heard of this particular one. You know, all the books we have from that time period, my husband will sometimes describe, I got to get both my hands in the viewer here. You know, it's like one short shelf, including a play by Nero's Pimp that we still have left of books from that time period. So for all of these reasons, that argument from Silence is poor. Now, as far as Herod's motives, it isn't actually true that he wasn't concerned with what happened after he died. One of the things that Josephus records is that Herod had the chief men of Israel locked up in the hippodrome when he knew that he was dying, and he made his immediate heirs promise that when he died, they would kill them all with darts so that there would be mourning at his death, which would otherwise possibly be an occasion of rejoicing. He burned a couple of people to death shortly shortly before his death because they had caused a disturbance in the temple. So this guy, if anything, I would say that the slaughter of the innocents is typical. I would say that what else we know, I would say like exactly the opposite of what Jonathan is saying. What else we know about the character of Herod, his monomanias, his egomania, and the way that he got bees in his bonnet and also treated life as having no value is actually completely consonant with this story of a nasty little brutal incident in a little town in Bethlehem.
But we know that the scribes found out about a prophecy that the Messiah was going to be born, and they were worried enough. And in fact, Jerusalem was worried with them. If I remember the quote from Matthew, this was a well-known problem. Okay, prophecy and thing that's happening, the Messiah is being born, that Herod does the bizarre thing of not going down and sorting out straight away and trusting the Magi, and has we have this situation that is not attested to, even though all these scribes and people in Jerusalem apparently know about this. And then, as I said before, Luke has them being warmly accepted into the temple in Jerusalem straight away afterwards, where it's all over the shop. And then when you understand the Magi as a retelling of the Black Balaam story from the Old Testament and a bit of Daniel thrown in, and when you see that in 66 CE, which would be sometime around before the time that Matthew is writing, a comet passed over and Tiridates, an Armenian king, and Magi went to worship King Nero and went back a different route. The language is exactly the same. And Matthew would have known this and say, you know, it all seems to be incorporated in, and it seems to be just theology contextualized and apparently historicized. And I think, you know, it's just jam-packed full of issues.
Well, you know, that statement about everybody knowing, or the scribes knowing the prophecy. By the way, I just want to mention that Luke doesn't mention that prophecy, so I don't think that was his motive in Luke. But that's by the way. I don't know if you know, Jonathan's under the impression that these Herod scribes were live blogging this or whatever, whether they knew about the destruction of the children in Bethlehem or not. We don't have what they knew. We don't have their perspective on it. Now, as far as the supposed parallel with the prophecy of Balaam, the prophecy of Balaam says nothing about magi. It says nothing about somebody bringing gifts. It is a prophecy that a star, or a statement that magi. A star will arise and a scepter out of Jacob. It's complete free association to try to connect this with this story. In fact, I can make up a better one for you. I can say, no, the better parallel is Athaliah, the descendant of Jezebel, killing all of the royal children except Joash was spared, and Joash was Jesus' ancestor, but he isn't in Matthew's genealogy. We can do this all day long. That kind of parallelomania, free association, has zero evidential value. If you think that you have reason to think this was made up, then you've got some other reason. Or if you think you have reason to think this wasn't made up, you've got some other reason. But adding a parallel that you can make up doesn't give you any additional reason to think it was made up. For example, I could say that the assassination of John F. Kennedy was a made up parallel for the assassination of Abraham Lincoln. But of course, in fact, both of them happened. So this really is evidentially valueless as far as telling us.
Let's have one more response from Jonathan, and we'll start to wrap things up at that point.
Yep.
So Luke and Matthew are really keen on this technique. We haven't actually mentioned the word at all, but it's called Midrash. These are Midrashic techniques, which are the kind of reinvention of Old Testament or rabbinic stories and reinventing them for a new audience and for their own particular agenda. And I think, you know, it's obvious that this is taking place, particularly in Matthew, but Luke is big on Midrash as well. And you know, it's to me, it's obvious that Jesus has to be the new Moses, especially because Matthew wants to appeal to the Jewish audience that he has. So if you're going to, you've got to take these big figures and say, right, Jesus is a bit like Jesus is better than Caesar or Caesar Augustus. Jesus is the new Moses. He's bigger and better. And look at what he does. He's fulfilling these prophecies. And Herod is the Pharaoh, the death of the firstborn. There's a Passover. Jesus survives effectively at Passover, goes to Egypt, comes out of Egypt, blah, blah, blah. This is just the way that Matthew does his theology. He's writing theology. And I would say he's embellishing accounts or even just outright mythologizing things to fit his theological agenda.
I do want to address that statement about Midrash briefly. That's all wrong. It's wrong for several reasons. Okay. First of all, that's not what Midrash is. As N.T. Wright has pointed out, what Midrash is like
versions.
What the Apostle Paul does in Galatians with the story of Hagar and Sarah. You would cite your story and then you'd make possibly a weird interpretation of it, but it's an interpretation of a story. It's not just making up a story. That's not what Midrash is. That gives a false air of objectivity to what is really just this free associative parallel mania. It's not actually a genre that existed at the time. As N.T. Wright has pointed out, it gives this air of objectivity to claiming that something was made up, which is actually bogus. It's just another way to assert that this was made up. We actually don't have evidence at all that there was this thing which was making up stories, which was called Midrash, and that's what Matthew is doing. If he were,
denying that Matthew saw Jesus as the new Moses? Are you denying that? I mean,
yes, I'm completely denying that.
So you think, right,
he could have done a much better job if that's what he was trying to
communicate. Well, we will have to start to leave it there. Final thoughts from you, Jonathan, and then we'll have Lydia, and then we'll have to close this up.
Okay, my final thoughts are there. I have literally hundreds of issues with the nativity accounts.
For those who are just listening rather than watching, you just held up a large sheath of paper, which obviously is full of other objections that we haven't got to tonight. But anyway, carry on.
I'm going to look like a Trump lawyer now, or his press secretary. Oh dear. But basically, I have just so many issues with the nativity accounts that they are, to me, just thoroughly historically problematic. And that's not even taking into account the fact that you need extraordinary evidence to provide epistemic warrant for extraordinary claims to be believed. And these are not extraordinary evidence. Two assertions in two gospels are not extraordinary evidence. And you can make it sound very technical, and you can bring out the theology, and there is wonderful theology going on here. But at the end of the day, we have assertions of the miraculous that are not attested to anywhere else, and that is hugely problematic. And I think, you know, you put it all together: contradictions, disconfirmation, historical intersections, and not being extraordinary evidence. I think this was, I wouldn't say fairy tale, but certainly mythological.
Okay, final thoughts from you, Lydia.
I do think that it's helpful to bring in the other evidence that we have of the reliability of Luke and Matthew. So I am not going to say that if we literally just had these accounts bare all by themselves, that would be, you know, totally enough to just believe them. But when we put them in the context of their gospels and of the other evidence we have, I do think we have good reason. Moreover, we have specific reasons, surprisingly a large number of specific reasons, even for these specific accounts. And the last one that I haven't had a chance to bring out that I'll mention briefly and then send you to my video to see the rest of is the mention of Archelaus in Matthew, which is pretty remarkable, because it ties it down historically that Archelaus was the tetrarch there, and that someone else was the tetrarch in Galilee, and that Archelaus had done something that would be frightening right at that time. So I'll be going into this more in my video series, which has just begun. I've only got two that I've done so far. I'm hoping to have five or six by the time I'm done. So we have reason to believe that this happened, both from our other reason to trust these authors and from the rather surprisingly numerous incidents of authenticity in the accounts themselves.
We will have to leave it there, but I really appreciate the way you've both engaged with each other. It's been a feisty and forthright debate today, and I've thoroughly enjoyed it. So thank you very much, Lydia and Jonathan. Again, if you want to find out more about them, check out A Tippling Philosopher at pathos.com for Jonathan's website and blog. More about Lydia at lydiamcgrew.com, and you can also find links to her video channel as well. Make sure that's all available from today's show. For the moment, Whether you believe the stories or not, I do wish you a very happy Christmas, both of you. Thanks for joining me on the show today. And yes, we'll see you hopefully in the new year.
Thank you for this opportunity.
Thanks for having me, Justin.
We'll look forward to hearing what you made of today's discussion. Again, you can get in touch via our social media. That's all available from the webpage, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. You can also email me unbelievable@premier.org.uk. Just a reminder, I'd love your thoughts as well via our survey mechanic. We're trying this out for the first time, but there should be a link with today's show if you're listening via podcast. Click that. It'll literally be 2 minutes or less to fill it in. It's a multi-choice thing. Just gauging your response to today's show. We'd love to see what you made of it. So go and check that out in the info with today's show, the survey on our Christmas stories debate. Looking back to last week's show, which was us airing that Q&A we did live streamed with William Lane Craig. Lots of good comments, lots of love and appreciation for that show. We tackled all kinds of issues. One thing that did come up from a few people, and I thought it worth mentioning this, was the fact that Bill mentioned in that a theory that it's possible the coronavirus was produced in a laboratory and that was where it originated. A number of listeners got in touch to say they didn't think that was true. So this, for instance, from Lena, who got in touch to say, you said carelessness that may have taken place in that Chinese lab that released this virus. Lena says that was a very serious statement that has fueled and will fuel conspiracy theories. Sadly, my impression is that Christians are more prompt to believe in conspiracy theories than other groups of people. But please check out this blog from Francis Collins, the director of the National Institutes of Health, and you direct me towards that. And yes, that's a pretty conclusive blog from Francis Collins saying that genomic research points to natural origins for COVID-19, that it wasn't developed in a laboratory situation. So thank you, Lena, and others who pointed that out. I have actually passed that link on to Bill as well. Here's another one from Robbie in Australia, who says, love so many episodes. They're always superb. Quick response on William Lane Craig on the hiddenness of God. Craig was great as always, but I thought it interesting that he chose to select that as the best argument against God. Craig mentioned a neon cross in the sky and went to explain extremely well why that wouldn't necessarily be something that God would do, defending his position nicely. However, I think the existence of the universe itself is in fact a much bigger figurative version of that neon cross. God didn't just place a cross in the sky that someone could explain away as a coincidental formation of light patterns, but rather created a whole physical universe for us to experience. I don't need to go into the many specifics of why the universe is so inexplicable, because they are regularly mentioned on the show. And in fact, Craig's own words on the cosmological argument illustrate the significance of the universe's existence beautifully. Anyway, you say, I'm certain I've heard a similar version of this response to God's hiddenness on previous episodes of Unbelievable, but can't remember when it was mentioned or by whom. Anyway, thank you very much, Robbie. Good to hear from you on that one. Still lots of response coming in as well to the debate we did on the God of the Old Testament. That was Dan Barker versus Martin Kurt. Here's Jacob, lives in Dallas, Texas. Huge fan of the show, you say. Thanks very much, Jacob. Emailing in regards to that show, I found myself wishing, not for the first time, that Tim Mackey of the Bible Project was the Christian representing the biblical side of the discussion. With that debate in particular, I felt Dan Barker's tactic, as is the approach of many naturalists and atheists I hear, was to de-spiritualize and decontextualize every passage he referenced, rather than express God's character as seen throughout the whole of the Bible. And I felt Martin conceded in playing Dan's game. Tim Mackey has such a thorough understanding how every book and chapter of the Bible, even the troubling bits, add to the whole story of the Bible. So when many of us start to draw unpleasant conclusions about God from the scary passages, many of which Dan referenced, Tim is able to explain how those passages fit brilliantly into the story of God's goodness. I would love to hear Tim challenge and push against Dan's attempts to flatten out the biblical story into a few isolated stories. Thank you so much, Jacob, for getting in touch. We are going to be revisiting the issue of the Bible. There's a great new book out by Dan Kimball, and it's called, I'm just going to look over on my bookshelf. It's called How Not to Read the Bible. That's what it's called. So Dan's going to be coming on the show, hopefully in the not distant future, to talk about that looking at some similar issues to what we covered with Dan Barker and Martin Kurt. With another skeptic. Hopefully we can get Tim Mackey on the show at some point as well. Another Tim in Saskatchewan Canada gets in touch on that show to say, I was looking forward to the episode, but unfortunately, what I observed was Barker bringing serious accusations that demand serious answers, and Kurt trying to soften the objections rather than answer them. The biggest hurdle Kurt had to overcome was the fact he appeared to be arguing from the platform of secularism, accepting the position that man was in the position of an unbiased moral arbiter. Once that grounds yielded, the argument's basically lost. It's because of the objections that Barker raised that I was originally driven to reform theology. This was the most poignant when the discussion regarding Job. Kurt seemed to completely whiff on the concept that the purpose of Job is meant to relay the disparity between God and man, namely that man's in no position to demand anything of God, because everything man receives is from God, and God reserves the right to retract his gifts. When Job has the ability to bring his complaint to God, he shuts his mouth and repents for thinking he was in a position to square with God. It's the exact opposite mindset of Job that Barker demonstrates, which gives the drive behind his position, and Kurt did nothing to correct that misconception. And on a similar sort of note, Paul gets in touch to say, I was amazed at how Dan Barker tolerates blatant contradictions in his worldview while thinking any supposed contradiction in the Bible is monumentally significant. He started his remarks on your show by saying that all good people want to work to see more love in the world, but he has no foundation for affirming anything to be good, and on his worldview, no freedom to work for it. I found it interesting that he affirmed the virtue of love, but the only reason love is objectively good is because it reflects the nature of the God who is love, and that can only be true because God is triune, a community of love. The God of the Bible is the only foundation for his objections. I think, therefore, his starting point is wrong. Dan starts with no foundation to designate anything as good or evil, so all we're getting is his personal opinions. Reading the particulars in the context of the whole story of the Bible puts a very different complexion on things, even as Richard Dawkins has acknowledged. Thank you very much, Paul. And a very similar point made here by George in Nevada, who says that the show's been a blessing, but my comment on the Barker-Kurt debate is that the content and meaning of the scriptures is whatever its authors intended. One of the things Mr. Barker doesn't seem to be taking into account in any of his arguments is the author's intent when they wrote the scriptures. The reader's task is to try to determine what the writers were trying to say about God, or whatever the topic is. Did the authors of scripture believe and intend to convey what Mr. Barker claims the scriptures say about God? He needs to make that case before drawing the conclusions he does. If Mr. Barker doesn't grasp what the authors intended to be understood, then whatever he says about what they wrote misrepresents them. It's okay to disagree with the author of a piece of writing, but it's disingenuous to misrepresent what they've said. That's from George out in Sparks, Nevada. And on that one again, and this is the one that was actually more relevant possibly to what Paul and Tim had to say. This is from David, who says, it's been a while, but I've been vigilantly listening to your podcast, even when I failed to keep up with others. I just wanted to comment on something I've observed recently, where you've had atheist guests on the show that say there's no objective morality, while also saying that Christianity is like a cancer, or that raising your children is tantamount to child abuse. In the same way that elves are good at magic and dwarves are good at mining, it's fast becoming a trope now that atheists will reject morality while simultaneously laying claim to it. What confuses me is the most is that no one, as far as I can recall, calls them out on this logical inconsistency. But thanks for the hard work in bringing us thought-provoking conversations each week. Thank you very much. Yes, well, in a way, one could always turn every debate on Unbelievable into a debate over the moral argument, couldn't we? But I do take your point, and I think it's quite a powerful one personally. So thank you for it, all of those who got in touch along those lines. There have been other emails that have come in as well around this, but I think we're just about out of time for now. So thank you very much for being with us on today's edition of the show. Just a final reminder to check out that survey. We'd love to see what you think. We're just trying it out. It's a bit of a new mechanic that we'd like to maybe introduce to some shows in the coming year, and we thought we'd give it a whirl on the Christmas edition today. So go and check it out in the info from today's show if you're listening via podcast. It'll take probably 2 minutes or less. It's a multi-choice thing. Just be interested in hearing your responses to today's show. For now, thanks for being with me on the program, and let me tell you what's coming up same time next week. It's our Christmas special. It is Christmas weekend. Gosh, that snuck up on us all, isn't it? It's a rather different one, of course, for most of us. Not so much family celebrations and things like that going on. But we hope we can bring you some reasons to smile on next week's show. Highlights from the past year, An interview with Nick Page on putting to bed modern myths about pagan Christmas celebrations, and some amazing stories that we'll be sharing too about people finding faith through Unbelievable and apologetics generally. So look out for that on your podcast or on your radio set at the same time next week. For now, thanks for being with me, and we'll see you next time.